underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester Center, Vermont, and Saratoga Springs, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a new Bachelor of Science degree in Public Health with a focus on social, physical, and behavioral sciences. strose.edu.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. On July 17th, 2014, a 43-year-old black man named Eric Gardner died on a Staten Island sidewalk after a police officer put him in what has been described as an illegal chokehold during an arrest for selling bootleg cigarettes. The final moments of Gardner's life were captured on video and seen by millions. His agonized last words, "I can't breathe," became a rallying cry for the nascent Black Lives Matter protest movement. A grand jury ultimately declined to indict the officer who wrestled Gardner to the pavement. In his new book, I Can't Breathe, A Killing on Bay Street, journalist Matt Taibbi writes about Gardner's life, the police practices that contributed to his death, and the rise of the Black Lives Matter movement. Matt Taibbi has been a contributing editor for Rolling Stone and the author of five previous books, including the New York Times bestsellers The Great Derangement, Griftopia, and The Divide. It is a pleasure to welcome Matt Taibbi back to this week's book show. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
What brought you to the subject and something that you wanted to look at in such detail?
A number of things. My last book before this had been about the criminal justice system, so I was interested in the whole theme of community policing a little bit. But to be honest, and I've had to think about this a lot since the book came out, another motivation that I had was that I wanted to get away from being a political opinion writer, and I wanted to tell a story, and I wanted to tell someone's story. And this, quite by accident, after the decision not to indict the police officers and Eric Garner's case came down, I went out to Staten Island just to talk to people on the street, and they told me a little bit about Eric the person, and I thought, this is the person's story that I want to tell, because otherwise, he'll just be remembered as a victim and no one will know.
Was there ever any concern on your part or any outward concern on anyone else's part that you as a white journalist was looking into this case?
Yes and yes. I somewhat naively, I guess, jumped into the idea of doing this without really thinking about that. I guess it's because part of what being a journalist is all about is we're constantly sticking our nose into places where we're completely ignorant, and the job is supposed to be to become educated about the topic in a shorter period of time as possible and to help people understand it. But as the project went on, I began to think there are things about Eric Garner's life that I will never understand because I'm white and he was black. And there are things about this neighborhood that I won't understand. But I also thought this isn't just a story about Eric Garner or Tompkinsville Park. It's also a story about broken windows and the criminal justice system and District Attorney Dan Donovan and even Donald Trump. It's a story about 200 years of American history that was predominantly, controlled by white Americans. So this is the kind of story that I think white reporters like myself have to start owning as well, and even if it's uncomfortable.
Let us talk and begin with broken windows and that policy and what it originally set out to do and ultimately what it became as this case came to the fore.
Broken windows was an idea that somewhat humorously, well, there's no humor in this story, but ironically, I guess you could say, grew out of a situation that had nothing to do with race. A young academic slash former probation officer named George Kelling in rural Minnesota in the early 60s was assigned to run a juvenile home for mentally disturbed young people. And in the process of doing that, he noticed that the people who were treating the patients were often letting them play out their neuroses without interfering in any way. So, for instance, they would break a glass or start tearing out ceiling tiles and not interfere because they wanted to play out the diagnostic situation. And his basic observation was that we should clean up the glass, you know. And then when he started to do that, he noticed that people, when you do create a more orderly environment, it turns the volume down on certain kinds of behavior and makes people less nervous and less violent. And so that was the genesis of a theory that basically said that if you crack down on the outward symbols of disorder, that people will be less inclined to commit more serious crimes or engage in other forms of disorder. And that became the basis of this new policing policy that is vogue all over the country now.
You write in the book that the enforcing of these invisible laws created a sense of safety and reassurance for citizens, which to Kelling was a major step forward. As you say, this had been dated back decades. At what point did it become part and parcel of what the police department in Staten Island was doing at the time of the death of Eric Garner?
I think that's a difficult question to answer. I think when Commissioner Bill Bratton arrived on the scene in New York and first took over the project of reforming the subways and then took over the whole police force, and he was very enamored with Kelling's ideas, which had been published in The Atlantic in the 70s. But he added this crucial element to it, which was this idea of policing by statistics. So not only are we going to crack down on minor behaviors, not only are we going to stop people who are drinking out of open containers or urinating in alleys or riding bicycles the wrong way down the sidewalk, we are going to record every time we do that so that we can show the public that we're doing something, among other things, so that they will be afraid to walk out in the street with a gun or with the idea of committing a more serious crime. So he introduced this idea of statistics-based policing, which basically said that police had to stop a certain number of people every month, and made everything about counting activity within the police department.
Tell us a little bit about Eric Garner, and as not only the subject of this case, but the subject of your book, and as a, for want of a better term, a character in the book, in writing about this man, you do not find, he is very complex, he is not, certainly not perfect, and there is a lot here to be concerned about in his background, violent relationships with women, and other brushes with the law along the way. So how did you deal with that?
Well, I found, you know, when I first went out into the street and people told me stories about Eric Garner, one of the first things that struck me about those stories was that everybody seemed to like him. He was somebody who, despite his flaws, had a terrific reputation on the streets in a certain way. He was not considered a mean person. He was funny. He might have been contradictory, but he was out there not because he wanted to be a kingpin, but because he had to feed his family. He had kids. He had a personality quirk where it was dating back to the 90s even. He had difficulty spending money on himself and would instead put every dollar that he made toward his children. And so he would be dressed in rags sometimes while his kids were all in name brand. He was just a complex, interesting character who, yes, absolutely had some things in his past that he had to get past. But one of the tragic elements of the story was that he was trying, it seemed to me, quite hard at the end to put his life back together and to get his family back together, and yet it all fell apart at the end.
You say if you don't describe people with all their pluses and minuses, if you don't describe them as three-dimensional human beings, you turn somebody into a symbol and reduce them to that. Do you believe that was what was happening with him?
I think perhaps inadvertently. A lot of that just has to do with how we cover the news in this country, especially in the Twitter age. Everything is about speed and concision. The Garner story was the ultimate Twitter age story. It had an explosive video that created powerful emotions on all sides. People instantly had opinions about it. And in order to understand who Eric Garner was, all people really wanted and needed initially was a line or two that allowed them to understand and place him into context. Was he a hardcore criminal? Was he completely innocent? Just somebody who was walking by when this happened? So this caricature developed in the newspapers that he was a seller of untaxed cigarettes who was arrested for selling cigarettes in the street. Actually, that turned out not to be true. It turned out that he wasn't even doing that on that day. But it's just the way that we cover the news now. There's not time to get into who people are. There's not time for nuance. Everything is concentrated and packaged so that people can have a take on things before we even get to that.
And it seems, I mean, obviously you knew this walking into it, but that how soon in working on this did you realize that the book, whether you wanted it to be about it or not, was going to be about race?
Oh, I knew it was going to be about race from the beginning. It had to be about race. This is a story that's almost all about race, but there were aspects of it that I didn't know. And as a white reporter and as a white person, as a white resident of a city, part of what the book became about was my own process of self-discovery and learning about things that I should have known about. I should have known. I wrote about community policing. I should have known that these legally meaningless ways, tools that police have for arresting people in inner city neighborhoods, like, you know, arresting people on charges like obstructing government administration or obstructing pedestrian traffic or refusal to obey a lawful police order, that those were essentially identical to the vagrancy laws or the impudence laws that had been used dating back to the slave catching days. This is something that has gone on for not just decades, but hundreds of years in this country. And I didn't know any of that. I don't even think George Kelling knew any of that or didn't know it for a while anyway. And that's kind of the shame of this story. It's part of what I hope people get come away with when they read the book.
Matt Taibbi is our guest. The name of the book is I Can't Breathe, A Killing on Bay Street. You write in the book, about a third of the way through, Garner was caught in the crossfire of 1,000 narratives that had little or nothing to do with him personally. Everything from a police commissioner's mania for statistics to the opportunistic avarice of real estate developers had brought him in contact with police that day. So he was fighting one man who rode his back, but also history. Do you think we're coming to understand that better in any way?
Yes and no. And the only reason I say it that way is because America is so totally polarized now that it's impossible to speak of us as a country in a monolithic way. I've said this before. I think the Trump movement represents an absolute denial of America's sins dating back to the very beginning of this country's creation. I think that's why there was such sensitivity over the tearing down, even of Confederate statues. This idea of blamelessness is woven very tightly into the fabric of the alt-right movement and the new conservative movement. On the other hand, on the other side of the political spectrum, there's more awareness of this now, but I wouldn't say that it's complete in the way that one might imagine. It's certainly taught in schools, but I think that there's still a little bit of self-deception going on, particularly among, you know, people like me, upscale, white, liberal, urban residents who maybe at one time or another voted for policies like this without knowing what they are.
Do you think that when you... I mean, that video is so disturbing and so damning, it seems. What do you think the effect of that video has been, both in us, for us as a society, but also in the case itself, where you have a police officer who is not indicted as a result?
Well, I think those two elements, the shocking nature of the video, the clear lack of a need to employ that kind of violence in that situation, coupled with the fact that there was no discipline, criminally anyway, for any of the officers involved, that opened the eyes probably of some white Americans. It certainly is not a surprise to most Black Americans. I think that they have been experiencing this forever, and that's also part of the story told in the book, is that, you know, these stories have been repeating themselves for decades and decades, and it's only white Americans who experience them for the first time with shock and horror. It's whereas it's old hat, you know, really in a lot of other places. So I think it did open some eyes. I think that, in conjunction with the cascade of other stories that were similar, from Freddie Gray to Michael Brown to Laquan McDonald to Sandra Bland to all these things, I think that has kept this issue in the news and made it more people more aware of it.
So when it comes to the Black Lives Matter movement, this is something that you wanted to write about, this movement as well, and the early days of it. How do you see that this case led in some ways to its arrival?
Well, it had existed before. It was created, if I'm not mistaken, in the wake of the Trayvon Martin case, which actually wasn't even a police issue so much, although it wasn't, you know, it wasn't. But it was a private citizen in that case who did the killing.
Right.
The Black Lives Matter movement, I do write about it in the story, but not extensively. I think more what I write about in the story is how there was an enormous amount of protest energy that emerged from this case, particularly after the decision of the grand jury not to indict the officer. And there was a lack of an organizing principle or an organization that might have harnessed that energy in a way that was more effective. It just kind of went out in the streets and dissipated, and that's what's described in the book.
When you look at where we are now, and you say this early in the book, because you do link this to where we are as far as this age of Trump and the of what he has said about race and the reactions to what he has said about race. Where are we? Because I've heard you say that you actually think that we're in a better place than most people think we are.
Well, that's only because I've lived in other parts of the world where, you know, I lived in Moscow, and I remember once walking down the street and seeing the sidewalk open and people fall into a vat of boiling water because a hot water pipe bursts open. I mean, in the third world, you know, bribery can be open in a courtroom. You can be beaten by a cop on the street. You know, there's in broad daylight, and nothing will happen. Although, of course, that's what's going on here too. I just think that America is still a relatively high functioning society. There are elements of our institutions that still work fairly well. We don't think about things like, if I put my money in the bank, is it going to be there tomorrow? Maybe we should think about it more, but I think Americans in a lot of ways don't realize how far we still have to fall if that's what we're going to do.
We have just a few moments, but I do want to get to something that we haven't discussed, and that is the actual chokehold used. What do we know about that and how it happened, how it was allowed to happen, and the reaction to it? Because this is something you are trained to do, correct?
Not really. You're not trained to use a chokehold. A chokehold is a banned procedure in the New York City Police Department, and it has been since 1985. You are not supposed to put your arm around the neck of somebody when you're taking them down. There are different ways. There are things that are called a submission hold, from what I understand, that are acceptable, and I think that's what the police officer's attorneys argued he was doing in this case. But I think that's belied by the videotape and by the fact that the police commissioner himself came out right after the case happened and said that this was a chokehold. Chokeholds are not supposed to be used. When an independent investigator looked at the use of chokeholds, he found that there had been over 1,000 complaints over a period of, you know, maybe a little over a decade, and perhaps only a dozen of those or 10 had been substantiated by the civilian review board. And of those, of those complaints, only a few resulted in punishments, and they were very minor, a few docked vacation days. So this is a problem. You know, I think that there's a major problem with how police are disciplined and what the review process is for people who use improper procedures.
You address this, but I'm just interested as we wrap up of what you'd like the takeaway to be. I mean, there's several takeaways from the book, but what would you like the takeaway to be?
I think in with all these stories, there's been so much attention paid to it, and people have already learned to have pretty strong feelings about police brutality, to be angry about it, to understand its ubiquitous nature, and to want to fight against it. I think what I hope they get out of this book is the idea that it's not just about things that happen on the street between a few cops here and there, and some unlucky, unfortunate citizens. This is institutional. It's built into the way the police force and the criminal justice system is designed to operate. There is an enormous bulwark of bureaucratic protections that are built in to the legal system to prevent people from investigating problem police or disciplining them after they commit acts like these. So I just hope that people understand that this is a problem that is not just broad but deep, that it's built into the system in a way that is going to require a lot of effort to unwind.
Matt Taibbi's new book is I Can't Breathe, A Killing on Bay Street. It is published by Spiegel & Graw. Matt, thank you very much for being with us. It's always a pleasure to have you on the program.
Joe, thank you so much.
We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LaDuke produces our program. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.